This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore, and we discuss how Star Trek changed paradigms and thought and entertainment, and a show that changed the course of old tropes to challenge the mindset that we can improve. In fact, you could say at times it can be a bit over the top, but we're going to discuss an episode when Star Trek brought its viewer into a new line of modern thinking, creativity, and charity.
Yeah, I really enjoy this episode. So the Corbomite Maneuver is an episode that began... That really began the thought process that this show could be very different, right? Science fiction wasn't new in the 1960s, and you had the monsters and threats of the week that they were common back then. But this was specifically for me a great episode in how to deal with threat, controlling our fear, seeking to understand, and bridging a gap to understand something alien to our culture.
Yeah, you know, with in old school science fiction, right? The aliens are always the enemy. You know, especially, you know, the way Baylock is presented here for most of the episode, he is the classic, like, large-headed alien. And once again, Star Trek kind of being ahead of its time, this is before the, you know, the gray, if you will, the gray alien that we always see these days. Little bodies, big heads, big eyes, you know, that's the cliche alien. If you see in, you know, the X-Files, it probably popularized it more in modern culture. But then if you see any kind of parody about, you know, Tucky's cheerleader or, you know, little UFOs and stuff, it's always these little gray guys with these big heads with this almond-shaped head. Is that the right, you know,
yeah,
term?
Yeah.
So Star Trek ahead of its time yet again, you know, and you see that and you think this is the enemy. But the whole point of this episode is putting aside those preconceptions and finding a friend where you otherwise might have found an enemy. So,
yeah, I think so. I also think that I wonder if Patrick Stewart watched this episode and said, ah, I know how I'm going to play Picard, just by watching Baylock, right? He had the deep voice imposing, and, you know, it was kind of similar.
No? Well, he didn't surrender at the end of the episode, so.
No. In fact, he didn't. No, he was all testing. But, you know, for me, when we were talking a week or so ago about what topic should we do, and, you know, we are trying to find that right balance of getting new listeners in and enjoying the movies and the reboots. But, man, you know, you go back to classic Trek, and when I say classic Trek, I put the quotes around the Corbomite Maneuver. And rewatching it again, it's just one of those episodes I could watch as many times as it was on because I really enjoy it. I watch it through, I guess, a different lens now, and... You know, it isn't perfect by any means, but for its time and for what it did, it was just amazing. And, you know, it was kind of clever. So here's the Enterprise. It was one of the first productions. They're exploring, right? It was United Earthship, not
yes.
United Starship
yes.
at this time.
Uhura is wearing gold.
She was wearing gold, which fit her very well, by the way. I wish they kind of kept that.
I don't know. See, you say that, but I'm glad she switched to red because it kind of breaks up the bridge a little bit, because you get these wide shots, and if you're looking like the classic, like you get the two guys at navigation and the helm, and you get Kirk and you get Spock over there and you get her, I'm like, that is a lot of gold. You know, there's a lot of Spock's the only guy breaking up that gold, so I can see why. I mean, look, Nichols looks good in anything, but she looks really good in red. I thought it helps break up the gold.
She does. Well, hey, you know, she is, I mean, she's a very beautiful woman, and I don't know. It was just something about, and maybe it's the way I capture it in my head, right? Because if you're wearing gold, you know, that's considered more or less a line officer. Line officers get to command, but, you know, Spock breaks that paradigm by wearing blue and being able to command, and second, same with Scotty and things like that. But, so that, I guess in my mind, it's like, okay, it puts her on an equal footing to potentially be sitting in that chair. Huh. And that was really an episode too, where I kind of felt for her because I, you know, you could do the drinking game with hailing frequencies open, with this episode, particularly for her.
You would probably pass out.
I think so. She said it a lot. God bless her. But, you know, the other thing I liked about this too, is this is when I really started to realize the whole McCoy, impact to the show, right? We had seen a few episodes by this point, if you were watching in chronological order, I can speak well. And McCoy really comes into his own on this. You know, he picks the wrong time to pick fights. He loves to argue. And one of the things that I caught, you know, was a line that he said in his, you know, if I was to jump every time I saw a blinking light around here, I'd wind up talking to myself, right? And I was thinking of Star Trek V. And I was like, okay, so that wasn't an original line. I had just kind of forgotten that. And I don't know if he says it more and more in the series. That's something I'm going to have to do a little bit more searching
and
on.
And of course, he is talking to himself when he says that, which is part of the comedy. But yeah, that's baked into McCoy's character. This is DeForest Kelly's first episode, right?
Right.
In production order. And McCoy is so well realized here, right? I mean, it's just like...
He is.
Yeah, from the jump.
Yeah, and the whole thing that I really enjoyed and probably was one of my one of the things that really had me liking Star Trek was the order and discipline on the ship. You know, Kirk was taking his physical. There's an emergency. He's got his crew in charge. You know, there wasn't that loud red alert yet. They hadn't kind of work that into the show at this time, just a blinking red light when things go bad, but no alarms. And everybody knew their job, took care of their jobs, and Kirk seemed such the normal heroic type captain. And some of his lines in this show were great, especially when dealing with Bailey and his inability to kind of handle things. But anyway, those were just certain aspects that I like. When we talk about the show, and we'll kind of go from beginning to end, I think everybody's seen it. If they need a quick synopsis, I guess we could do that quickly.
Huh? Yeah, I can summarize this. Try it. Time me, folks. Let's see how quickly I can get through this. But so this is the general long and short of the Corbinite maneuver, not the Carbonite maneuver. That's Star Wars. I know when I was younger, I would just get these confused. But there's Corbinite and there's Carbonite. There's a difference. So
see, Star Wars stole from them again. It's unbelievable.
Star Trek did it first yet again. So the episode starts out. The Enterprise is star charting, you know, unknown space. They come across a colorful cube that blocks their path. They try to get around it, but it keeps, you know, getting in front of them. They cannot escape it. They try really hard to get away from it, and then it starts emanating radiation, which is deadly to the crew, obviously. So they have no choice but to destroy it. And then they're presented with the opportunity, okay, do we move forward or do we turn around? Because Spock basically postulates this thing had two purposes. It was either a warning buoy to stay away or flypaper to trap us for something bigger to come and deal with us later. Either way... not good for the Enterprise. So logic would dictate, you know, to turn around. But Kirk's like, no, we have to keep going. This is our mission. As they say many times this episode, the mission of the Enterprise to seek out and contact alien life. So you can tell that this was the first episode. They're establishing their mission statement. So I thought that was interesting. So they press forward. And as they press forward into this uncharted space, they come across a much, 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 much bigger ship, a spherical ship, called the Vasarius. They're from the First Federation, and these are, I've compared these before to, like, it's the Borg ships of their time, right? They're all these geometric objects of various sizes, right? And you get the iconic shot of the Enterprise coming up on this giant ship, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, takes up the whole screen, the Vasarius, and they get over the comm system, they get Commander Baylock, and he says, you have 10 minutes and he will be destroyed, you've been found unworthy, and So it starts this countdown of, okay, you violated our space, you ignored our warning buoy, we're going to destroy you. And that's the end. That's the end of the conversation. Like, there's no negotiation. Kirk keeps going back and forth, as we mentioned. Uhura has to keep opening hailing frequencies. And gosh, she probably says it 6 or 7 times in this episode. Hailing frequencies open. Like, if you made a super cut of her with saying that line, about probably half of it would be from this episode. But they go back and forth. And meanwhile, while this is going on, our navigator, this is pre-Chekhov, all right? This is season one, so it's Mr. Bailey. And he has a little subplot in this episode of, you know, just probably not being up to the task, right? It's referenced that Kirk might have promoted him too quickly. He starts to kind of buckle under the pressure. He's sluggish to respond to orders and gets kind of easily overwhelmed with the situation. It all comes to a head when, you know, Baylock starts counting down, like, we have 7 minutes left. And Bailey starts freaking out. He's like, he's doing a countdown. And he flips out, and Kirk has to dismiss him from duty. McCoy, who had been talking to Kirk about Bailey earlier in the episode a couple of times, calls Kirk out and says, I'm going to write this up in my medical report, which is, by the way, an absurd time to talk about this, because we're literally 5 minutes away from complete destruction, and you're going to talk about writing Kirk up in your medical report. But regardless, you know, this sets Kirk off, and he says, don't try to bluff me, doctor. But that gives him the inspiration to bluff Baylock, right? Because Spock had compared their situation to chess. It's like, when the player is outmatched, the game is over, checkmate. But then Kirk gets this inspiration from Bones' antagonization about poker. And he's like, not chess, Mr. Spock, poker. So he gets back on the comm, and he bluffs to Baylock that the all-Earth ships have a device called Corbomite, which matches the destructive force met from its adversary and destroys the enemy ship, and it's been in Earth service for 200 years, and it's a secret because the first Federation ship, the Fisarius, had scanned the Enterprise and read all its records, so Kirk had to say that this is a secret, but we thought it's fair to let you know that if you destroy us, you will be destroyed as well. And, you know, they're still waiting on the countdown. They get no response to this. It seems like Baylock doesn't care, but then the timer goes out. Enterprise is still there, so everybody's pretty happy about that, but they're not out of it yet, because Baylock gets back on. He's like, your destruction has been delayed. And I'm going to call it the Little Fisarius. Now, the Little Fisarius comes out. It's the command module of Fisarius. Comes out. Ken is doing the mini-me, pinky to the mouth now. But yes, the mini Fisarius, we'll call it that. The big Fisarius goes back from whence it came. And the mini Fisarius is going to tow the Enterprise to a Class M planet to unload the crew. And then, of course, destroy the Enterprise. That's what Baylock announces. But obviously it's a much smaller ship, so there's a lot more strain on it. So over time, the Enterprise waits for its moment of opportunity to break away from the mini Fisarius' tractor beam. It does. This shorts out the power on mini Fisarius. Baylock sends out a distress call that his systems are failing, his life support is failing. He's in trouble. The power is so weak, though, on mini Fisarius that the Enterprise is probably the only one in range that heard the call. Kirk decides that we're going to go help them because, you know, that's what we do. We take the high road, right? The golden rule. And they beam over there. Kirk takes McCoy and Bailey, again, putting Bailey in a situation he's probably not prepared for. Bailey had come back on the bridge right before the timer had expired to kind of, you know, go down with the ship at his post. And everybody had kind of come to an understanding there with him. And Kirk had felt kind of bad probably about how the way he treated him. So he's like, I owe you a look at the unknown. Come with me over to the mini Fisarius. Which is an interesting choice of away team, but it's a landing party, I guess. This is away team is a Next Generation term. In the original series, they called it a landing party. But this would be a boarding party. So the boarding party is Kirk, McCoy, and Bailey. They beam over. It's a smaller ship, so they kind of have to crouch over when they beam over, which is kind of a funny visual. They get onto the Fisarius, and they see that the Baylock they had seen on the screen that had been presented to us, as we mentioned earlier, the gray alien, big-headed looking guy, is just a puppet. Then we hear from another room that, hello, I am Baylock. And it is a child-like alien. Obviously, you know, this race is just smaller in stature, right? And he looks like a child, but he is the commander of the Fisarius. He explains that he uses the Baylock visage as an intimidation factor to make people scared. And he says that you wouldn't be scared of me. I don't know. I probably would have been more scared of little Clint Howard. Because it's eerie, right? It's eerie that this little guy is an alien commander. But they all have a good cup of Tranya, and Baylock just says this was all a test to see if you were, you know, worthy, or if your intentions were true. Enterprise passes the test. Baylock also says that he's lonely. He's the only guy that controls the whole Viserys. He would like some company. Kirk volunteers Bailey, and Bailey's all excited about it. Says, oh, yeah, absolutely, sir, I volunteer. So Bailey's going to go hang out with Baylock for an indefinite amount of time. And then they go on a tour of the Viserys that we don't really get to see because, you know, it's the 60s and there's no budget, but that's fine. And the episode ends. And, you know, we learn that, again, don't judge a book by its cover, right? It's a good old Aesop fable wrapped into a 23rd century package and the Corbomite maneuver. So there you go. That's the long and short of it, Ken.
Oh, that was very, very well. That was very detailed, actually. Because if you think about it, watching it like, I guess I watched it last night, you could cut a lot of this show out. There's a lot of staring at view screens. There's a lot of times where they just close up on the faces. With all these colors flashing, it was kind of a prelude to the motion picture in many ways.
I got that same vibe, Ken, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, okay, you could probably have knocked this down. And so the story itself was short. And they could have got the message across, but of course you have to fill out whatever it was, 48 minutes of...
I believe it was, gosh, I think it was 52 minutes back then. So it's
52?
As opposed to these 40 minutes of today's hour television.
Yeah, it's a whole different world. But at any rate, it still was fine. The other thing was, too, for back in the day, the special effects were pretty big, and that's why the show broadcast when it did. It took a while to get all the effects shots done. Even though it's a really a bottle episode, it's you know, 90% of it takes place on the bridge with a little bit in Kirk's quarters and in the sick bay, and then an even smaller amount in some beatnik hippie parlor that is Baylock's ship, I guess. But it definitely had, you know, they spared no expense on the curtains for Baylock's ship. But at any rate, it was really, really cool. I mean, it starts off, which I thought was really interesting, with the whole buoy, you know, and what's the next step? Because they sit there for 18 hours. They make that clear, and they're trying to figure out, okay, what do we do? Do we go forward? Do we go back? Do we turn around? What happens? And, you know, it's funny because every step of the way, the young, inexperienced officer wants to do what an inexperienced person does when they're afraid: destroy it, move away, run away. And you have Kirk, who obviously is a young commander, is really schooling everybody on that ship onto how we're going to approach this. And they come up with a pretty unique, you know, we're gonna you know, do a spiral course and try to get around it, which doesn't work. But prior to that, you know, Spock's, you know, it's either two things: it's a warning or it's flypaper, and, you know, a trap for other ships to come get them. And they decide to go on, which I thought shows a lot of maturity and a lot of risk. You know, you put yourself in certain situations, you really do have to understand the mission. And it kind of harkens back to the days of NASA, you know, in the mid-1960s. There were a lot of things that went wrong, trying to get into space. I mean, for all their successes, there was a lot of loss of life, a lot of loss of equipment. It was an emboldened age when people took risks. And that's what I saw Captain Kirk kind of driving from. You know, this mindset is, maybe it's the wrong decision, but this is what we do. We drive forward. We try to seek out and find new alien life. That is our mission, not to turn tail and run. And it kind of had this not so much a macho feel to it, but you know what, this is what drove explorers for centuries in Earth, right? People that had that ability to jump above their fears, not to take the easy road, and to keep driving. And so in many ways I felt this episode defined Captain Kirk.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Ken, because there's a reputation that Kirk has, little fire phasers, and, you know, he's not the diplomat that Picard is in the future. But here, he's the guy saying, all right, let's cool it. Let's talk. Let's think about it. We're not just going to blast our way through things. He's, you know, taking a very mature approach to it. And, you know, there's a lot of leadership skills you can learn from Kirk here, you know, and that's the great part of this episode, because, you know, we can all kind of put ourselves in the Bailey role, right? Because I think he's the audience in this episode. He's the point of view character because he's so, you know, overwhelmed by what's going on. And he's a Starfleet officer, but he's younger and he was promoted quickly. So that's a point that, I mean, there are reasons for him to act the way he does, right? Because everybody else is pretty cool, during all this, right? Sulu's doing the, he's like, oh, well, we have 5 minutes left. You know, he's doing the countdown, and that's the stuff that kind of sets Bailey off. But everybody else is just kind of facing death with dignity, and he's having a problem with it, you know? And I think, you know, I don't know, Ken, you're a military man, right? Do you think someone in that position would have faced their death with dignity like that? Or is like, what would, you know, in your point of view, right? If this is a, you know, on this naval-like vessel that the Enterprise is, right? What would the general reaction to something like this be? Would people be more like Bailey, or would these trained officers be more like everybody else?
You know, in Star Trek II, when Kirk is saying we have to put the ship on active duty, and he asks Spock if these kids are ready, you know, and how will they respond? And he says kind of each with their own gifts. In this episode, I felt that that probably in today's world, it would be a real mix. There are people that join the service, I think, and they did when I joined, especially in the 90s, when after the after Gulf War I, you know, there really wasn't a lot going on. You know, the Soviets were done and so forth, and people were trying to screen around for a meeting. And I know people that joined to go to school and all this other stuff, but not necessarily, you know, to go on adventures like this. I think the difference is, and what makes it difficult to compare to today's Navy and fleet is there's probably several other ships around. You're not all that far away from support if you need it. There are times when you are, of course, but the Enterprise is truly alone, right? Uh-huh. And I guess I would almost compare it more to maybe submarine warfare. I've never been in a submarine, but I'm assuming that that's what it must be like, where, you know, you have the elements as a danger. If the ship fails, you die.
That's true.
You know, the odds of survival are pretty low. I'm sure they've got, you know, plenty of redundant systems. But I would think that there would be a level of training for each of those officers. For those that serve aboard submarines, they have to go through a lot of psychological testings. They really have to be tested to really understand if they can handle kind of a claustrophobic environment, you know, because it hasn't always been successful there either. So I would think that the crew of the Enterprise would be more like that was demonstrated. For every one person that was kind of panicking, the other eight or nine around them would be fine.
Right.
And everybody has a breaking point. And that's where McCoy was really hard on Kirk, because he says, you push this kid too far too fast. And so there must be something that's very measurable in that timeline to make sure that people are ready for the strains and stresses. You know, and that's why, for me, not to jump on a TNG type thing, but that was always a piece of having the families aboard that I didn't like, was you're putting a lot of people that didn't sign up for anything at risk in a very scary environment, or potentially devastating environment. So, you know, that was one of the things about that show, that when you go back to an episode like this, and there were many times in TNG when they faced similar circumstances, this became a trope in Star Trek.
Absolutely. Even as early as the original series, like season one, like they find a advanced alien race who has to determine if they are worthy to survive, right?
That's right. So you see it a lot. And so it just to me, I guess, it really hones in on how well thought out this show was in its mission, that they truly are explorers, that they're very much on their own, that their risk is high at all times. And it really defined, I thought, Captain Kirk as the ultimate commander. Because you're right, Zach. There's a lot of things like, oh, he's quick to fire phasers, all this other stuff. You know, if you switch Kirk with Sisko, it's the same captain, really. They're both extraordinarily intelligent, very strategic. And, you know, once in a while, they don't hesitate to throw a punch.
You know? Right.
Which is, you know, sometimes that stuff happens. But, you know, there was recently, too, something that was put on Facebook that shows really the amount of times that Kirk got entangled with a woman. It really wasn't that many. And so there's a lot of things that kind of got caught up, like a few episodes defined him versus the whole body of work. But what I really liked about his command style was he was definitely the leader. You know, he would do things to check to see if his orders made sense, like bouncing off what he thought he should do with Spock. And Spock comes back to him and says, why do you ask me if you've already made up your mind, right? And he likes to have that emotional check that he's going in the right direction.
Right. Well, and that's important as a leader to, you know, give everyone under you an equal voice, but then ultimately have the confidence in making your own decision. Because you, if you're a leader and you're uncertain, that's poison in the water, right? Then everybody gets uncertain. You're like, well, I'm listening to this guy up here. He's not even sure what he's doing, right? But you can learn. Star Trek has such great captains. You can learn a lot of leadership skills from these guys, especially even a quote unquote hothead like Kirk, right? Because as we're always saying, there's a stereotype has developed over the years. Yeah, he broke a few rules, but he's pretty by the book when it comes down to it, right? I mean, in the movies, he's a little more rebellious, but if you look at the show proper, he's always, stressing over violating the Prime Directive and, sticking to their orders and all that kind of stuff. So he knows what he's doing, right? He's not out there just, phasers first, shoot first, ask question later. He's just shoot first, ask questions later. He's just as thoughtful as the perception of Picard is, they have different styles, but ultimately, he didn't get where he is by breaking all the rules, right?
Yeah, two very different approaches, right? You have Kirk, who's the staunch leader, I think, in the beginning, who mellows out in time, has a lot of conferences in the staff with the team, with the leadership team in many, many episodes.
Mm-hmm. Even they're in this episode, they're in the conference room. People forget that. People say, oh, Next Generation, they go to the observation lounge all the time. Well, there's just as many scenes in the briefing room with the original series. When you gather your experts, you hear their opinion, and you base your next move off of that. Because, as Bones says in the motion picture, like, your people, they know their jobs, right? Let them do their thing, right? And that's what Kirk's doing. He hears the analysis from, he gets reports from everybody. And I like how Scotty gives him, like, a just meaningless report. He's like, so, Scotty, how does this cube work? Oh, I don't know, Captain. It's like, oh,
that's my report.
That's your report. Thank you.
Yeah, the honesty was pretty cool. But there was some really, really good lines, especially in Bailey. He says, I vote we phaser it or shoot it or whatever. And he says, I'll keep that in mind when this becomes a democracy. It just slams him right down, right? And that's the kind of stuff as someone who leads a group. And if you've ever seen Crimson Tide, Gene Hackman's character was very much like, uh-huh. Actually uses that line, We exist to save democracy. We don't practice it, right? Yeah. And that's a common line too, even in the service. It just is. It's like, I'll listen and we'll take considerations, but ultimately there's one leader that's been trained to do all these things. And don't forget, folks, if you're a captain of a ship, you've been trained for many, many years in theory. And I understand and that's probably the sticking point they have with the new series or the new movies is he just went right from the academy to the captain seat. And that's a pretty big leap even for me, uh-huh. who's a huge Kirk fan, to see that. And a lot of it is because of the way he can kind of outthink and take risks where people have they got a little cozy. But anyway, that was pretty good. It was also
about Bailey though. Before we move on too far from that, I like that he's basically if to bring a TNG comparison, he's kind of like a Barkley, just a flawed person in a perfect environment, and I like that because it just makes everything a lot more relatable. Again, he's the point of view character, right? I mean, if any of us were put in that situation, we'd probably react that same way. not that if we didn't have the Starfleet training and all that, we might have a little different, but it's like, I feel kind of bad for him because like, man, I might forget to lock phasers too if I was overwhelmed by the situation. Because we've all been in situations where we're overwhelmed by stuff and we freeze up, And I feel bad for Kasulu's having to like reach over and do all his work. They might have played it up a little too much with him, but you have less than an hour to get the point across. So you have to show where this guy's failings are. But if he had displayed this amount of incompetency on a regular basis, he probably still wouldn't be sitting there next to Sulu. So he's having a particularly bad day, but the circumstances are extraneous. So anyway, but that was cool to see. That was cool to see obviously you're not going to make one of the quote unquote main characters be that way. But at this point, there were no main characters established. So like if this was like the first, obviously this is the first episode produced properly in this show, and you saw this, if you saw this first, like you were theoretically supposed to, you would have thought, oh, well, this guy is just, he's the same as Sulu and Scott and McCoy and Uhura. They're all listed in the credits just by their by their last name, so they're all pretty much equal at this point. And you don't know any better. You know, he's the guy sitting next to Sulu. Who's to say that he's the rotating guest star of the week? We know that now, looking back. But at the time, everyone's on equal footing, right?
Yeah, I wonder, you know, in those early years, if they never brought Walter Koenig to the show, if sitting in the navigator seat would have been equivalent to being a redshirt. Because they just have a lot of navigators or a lot of people that sit in that seat that wind up taking very prominent roles, right? If you think about Balance of Terror, if you think about Where No Man Has Gone Before, this episode, those navigators, man, they drive a lot of the plot. So
even,
that,
even on
the
animated series, there's what is it, Lieutenant Walking Bear? He's the Native American. I think he's actually takes Sulu's spot in that episode, but yeah, it's just like whenever we need like a guest star crew member to, you know, be part of the essential part of the story, they're always going to sit at one of those two seats. So yeah, good point there.
You know, in that same episode of TNT, was it Nagilum? Was that the name of the creature?
Where Silence Has Lease. Yeah.
Where Silence Has Lease, right? Now, I know that it's the left side, which then became the con, but even that guy got killed.
Yeah, the Wesley takes one shift off, and then that guy dies. And he, you know, even though in TNG they're green shirts, right? This guy's wearing a red shirt, so it was early enough in TNG where he was wearing red.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So maybe there's just something about sitting on the right side of the captain that's, you know, that's a high-risk element to things. I don't know. But... you know, as we were kind of coming back to Bailey, as you were saying, you know, there's an awful lot of training, obviously, that occurs to try to make sure that they have the right people to do the right things. And a lot of the training is pretty intense in any service, no matter where you go, to kind of weed those folks out that can't handle it, no matter what it is. And you see it. And that's why they try to make training as realistic as possible. But in the back of your mind, you know it isn't. But when you're out in the elements, when you're out in a storm, when you're out in this and you're training, quote unquote, man, oh man, you can really kind of see who could handle it in the real world and who can't. And then, you know, you wind up taking those people, you know, off your ship, off your boat, off whatever, and it's like you're in charge of inventory, right?
So right. Well, you want to set stressful. People up for success. You know,
and I think that Kirk was probably pushing this kid a little bit to kind of, you know, give him some confidence. You know, it seems strange to me that he wasn't relieved a lot sooner. I don't really understand what Kirk was trying to do, but you do see that a lot of times where people are like, "No, you know, we're gonna find out what your limit is." Mm-hmm. And you know, McCoy saw it. Other people, I guess, probably were starting to see it, but for whatever reason, Kirk was a little stubborn, and I think it was a big piece of his education and training in command was, you know, you got to be a little bit more watchful of these things, but. You know, all in all, it wound up being great. And at the end, when Bailey stays with Baylock, he gets the best assignment for an explorer could ever have. From that point of view,
so talk about cultural immersion, right?
Right. And the Kirk's line, you know, when he says, when Baylock says, one of your best then, and Bailey's like, nope, I'm pretty flawed. And Kirk just stepped right in. Yep, and I'll get a better officer in return. Didn't miss a beat. What a great line. You know, just... It just brought a lot of humor and kind of defuses the whole situation.
Like, yeah, you throwing some shade laughing. At Bailey there, Kirk.
That's right. It was just, you know, and you know what? There's a lot of guys that do that. You know, they use that humor. You know, we're all training and doing things. We all screw up, and you have to have a lot of humility, and you have to have a sense of humor, which is so important in stressful situations. Oh,
absolutely, you got to defuse that tension for sure. So yeah, so they've unloaded an incompetent officer, and they'll get a better one when Bailey's tour of duty is up with Baylock. It's, you know, but you know, if this was a later show, maybe we've gotten a second appearance of Bailey to kind of follow up on what happened. Of course, this is the episodic television of the 60s, and rarely was there continuity of that degree in the original Star Trek series. But it would have been interesting to see how that went, right, with Bailey, see how he would what he had learned. Right from Baylock, and it's very different. What a different experience, though, right? He's the navigator on the Enterprise, and now he's just hanging out with Baylock on this huge ship, which I can only assume you think about what is the inside of like the big Viserys look like. I always think of like, you know, Forbidden Planet or something, right? This giant, you know, hallways and, you know, all kinds of technology and all kinds of cool stuff. Stuff that we could never see on the 60s budget, but your imagination fills in the gaps, right? But yeah, it would have been cool to get any kind of follow-up. And actually, there have been some novels and things of that nature. In fact, there was a recent novel that just came out that's I believe it's called Face of the Unknown. And it's kind of a sequel to The Corbin Mite Maneuver. And I've not read it, but it's actually a very recent novel. And I'm curious to kind of see what it's all about and if it kind of follows up on any of these points we've been talking about. So
yeah, be an interesting. It's funny, you know, I'm reading a book that you gave me, thank you. And it's hard to keep up with all the things in the books. I don't know how the folks at Literary Treks do it. I don't know where they find the time. I really don't. God bless them. I'd love to.
Well, they're in the Nexus, Ken. So they get.
Okay. Well, that explains everything. But at any rate, yeah, it would be fun. And I used to be a big novel reader back when I was a lot younger, and seemed to have time. One thing I wanted to hit on, Zach, was your opinion. This is the first time, I think she's in the other episodes, but this was the first time that she was on the show, was Janice Rand, Yeoman. And I thought it was interesting, you know, when she comes into the captain's quarters with his new dietary food, which was, you know, just a salad, I guess, essentially.
What is this?
What is this? Some great lines there. And also where he says, you know, if I can talk to the person that set me up with a female yeoman, I thought was an interesting line. Most yeomen in the military, maybe I'm wrong. It could probably be more male than female. I don't know. But yeoman's typically an admin rate. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And And I think McCoy asked him, I forget the line he says, but I remember Kirk's reply was, I've already got one female to worry about. Her name is Enterprise.
Yeah, he's like, you don't trust yourself, Jim?
Something like that, yeah.
For Rand, yeah, it's she's funny in this episode because she's bringing the captain salad, and then later on she's bringing everybody coffee, and like, yeah. I thought the whatever's were down. She's like, oh, I just used a hand phaser to heat up the coffee. She's passing out coffee, and she's it creates a very casual environment, you know, which is interesting to see. And a lot of these early episodes, you see people just hanging out, chomping on snacks, drinking coffee. It's like, you know, if I was on the, hey, you tell me, Ken, but if I was on the bridge of a naval destroyer, I don't think I'd just be eating some food cubes or whatever we we do in this episode. I don't know. It seems rather casual.
Everybody has their coffee. You know, my hands are forever crooked as the reputation for chiefs, senior chiefs, and master chiefs go in the Navy, that, you know, you never see them without a coffee cup in their hand. In fact, even the statue that they created for the chief petty officer has him with one hand on a Samson post, you know, that what you tie off a ship to, a pier pole, with a cup of coffee.
But was it a Dixie cup though, with a little line around it? That's classic 23rd century.
No, but that's a space coffee cup.
That technology has not been invented yet, right?
That's right. So space coffee cups are obviously very different,
right,
from today's coffee.
So Rand, though, I guess, was she doing what a yeoman would do on a ship? Because my only point of reference for what a yeoman is Star Trek. So,
no, I well, you know,
handing the captain funny. The captain's log, you know, that kind of stuff, right? Is that what they do on ships? I don't know.
The captain's log today, I think, is probably recorded more, but they still have a handwritten log that's done by usually somebody else. Uh-huh. And usually, too, on a ship, the captain and the first officer are very rarely on the bridge, only at times when they're needed, you know, when there's an exercise or there's something, because they're off running different elements of the ship, and the officer of the deck actually commands it, which makes sense, right? Because, you know, in every Star Trek episode, regardless of what it is, you always have the captain in the center seat, the first officer to the right or left, depending on what episode it is. And that's just not how it works.
It's like, man, it's like the easiest job.
It's not feasible.
I just sit in this chair.
Yeah, and it's not
and
feasible.
Wait for something
right?
to happen.
You can't, right. You know, you can't, you know, they said they were waiting for 18 hours. It reminds me of, I just did a Nemesis rewatch, you know, waiting 17 hours. And right. It's like, you wouldn't be sitting in that chair for
that
17
That is not
hours.
An yeah. efficient use of your time, sir.
No. So the executive officer is actually portrayed very accurately in TNG. Mm-hmm. In terms of a lot of the orders that he gives or she gives, and usually has an office somewhere in the ship, and the executive officer is actually responsible for running the day-to-day. That is his role. setting up the plans, all that other stuff. You know, the captain's more strategic, you know, looking over the overall and the running of the ship.
Three shifts versus four shifts, right, Ken? Very important.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the folks that they call the officer of the deck, who's actually on the bridge, making sure that the ship stays on course. The captain's orders are laid out so they know exactly what they're supposed to be doing that day. And if they run drills or if there's an operation, like I said, well, then things change. You usually have the captain, the executive officer, you know, maybe one's on the bridge, one's down in combat, whatever. But, you know, getting back to your question about the yeoman, that's a little different. Usually, if it's a capital ship or if it's a big ship, there might be somebody that's assigned to the captain, an aide or something along those lines. Or they'll just send a runner, right? If the captain wants food or something like that, then Schmedlap, I always use that term, but that's absolutely right. They'll have some seaman or whatever. They'll be like, hey, you know, go grab some crew. Or there'll be people down in the galley, actually, who are responsible for feeding the men and women on a ship. If they're at general quarters and they can't leave, they will send runners out with food, right? So they always come up with these things. The Janice Rand, it was funny, I was thinking about it. I've got an admin, you know, where I work. And very similar, you know, you're working long days or whatever, and almost like a mother. And, you know, my admin does the same thing. She'll be in and she'll be like, have you eaten today? And I was like,
would
yeah,
you
I'm
stop
good,
hovering
you know?
Over me, yeah. Yeoman?
Yeah, that type.
Yeah, it's funny. It kind of
get it a lot, but that had happens.
It carries over from the Cage almost, right? With Pike getting used to having a female yeoman as well. Because a lot of these early episodes, Kirk is a lot like Pike, right? Because, I mean, that was the mindset they were writing the characters in. You know, as Shatner continues on with the role, they cater it more to his sensibilities, right? But in these early episodes, you can see a lot of parallels between, you know, the character established by, you know, Jeffrey Hunter's Pike in The Cage, and then now, you know, who William Shatner is playing as Kirk here. He is a lot more serious in these episodes, although I will say, when, you know, talking about these scenes with Rand, you know, I love this scene. One of my favorite scenes probably in the episode and in the original series here is between Kirk and Bones, and they're talking, and they get the update from Spock, like, efficiency at 94%, Captain. And Kirk's like, let's try get it up to 100, Mr. Spock. And Spock says, agreed. It's so perfect, right? It's exactly what Spock would say. And then Bones is like, what are you going to do with that 6%, Jim? He's like, well, I'm going to take it, and I'm going to... And then, of course, they get interrupted by Rand. But it's just, you know, it's just a very human moment, right? And I love that. It just, and again, like, this, the characters are so well-formed and well-established here in what is their, you know, second episode together for Kirk and Spock, and first episode for McCoy. So, I mean, a real testament to the writers and the actors, really, for figuring these guys out. And, you know, we get shouty Spock a little bit at the beginning. He's like, photographing.
Yeah, a little bit.
And then, of course, he like berates Bailey for raising his voice later on. It's like, hey, Spock, let's take your own advice, man. Yelling about photographing things and stuff. So there's a little, you know, Spock's still a little rough around the edges. But for the most part, I mean, you really understand where he's coming from. And, you know, I like later on, you know, I mentioned in the summary where he deduces that they have been, you know, checkmated, right? And Kirk's like, that's it. There's no other options. And he starts to say, I'm sorry. But then he stops himself and he says, I regret that I'm unable to find any more logical alternatives. Right. And I'm like, man, that is so like language through the Spock filter. Right. I mean, that's so good because that shows you like his, even in the face of death, he's going to be professional, much like, you know, much like in Wrath of Khan. Right. He's dying from radiation, but he stands up and he straightens his uniform, right? Right? Because that's what Spock does. I'm like, man, this is like from episode 2 for Spock. So well established here. I know in Leonard Nimoy's book, you know, I Am Spock, he talks about how the director of this episode, whose name escapes me at the moment,
Joe Sargent.
Okay, Joe Sargent. He helped him kind of establish the Spock character, right? Because they wanted some kind of reaction from Spock when they see the Viserys. And he just says, fascinating. Right, and that became like him, Nimoy working with the director there, Joseph Sargent, as you said, Ken. That informed Spock, and that became like his catchphrase. Right, there's live long and prosper, there's fascinating. Right, that's like if you had a Spock action figure, you know, you push a button, he says five things. Right, that would be one of them. Right, and it's the genesis here in this episode. So,
that's cool. I think that's why I really love this episode so much is the dynamic of the crew, that, you know, it's a well-oiled machine. Considering how early they made this episode, it felt like the chemistry was right. Bones fit right in, you know, cantankerous pain in the ass. Spock, second in command, but at the very beginning of the episode, he is in charge. He's running everything, no problem. Kirk, you know, shows a lot of trust and confidence in his team, right? He's running up, he's coming out of a physical, and he's going up to the bridge, and he's like, you know, is anything going on? Fine. I'm going to go change first. You know, so in other words, you guys got this,
right?
And I'll get there when I get there. You know, there wasn't anything that needed him. And there's a lot of people out there whose egos would never allow that. You know, I've got to be the guy in the center because there's an emergency, instead of trusting his team. And then when he goes down to his cabin with McCoy, when they're running the drills, you can hear all the drills running in the background. Uh-huh. You know, you hear the communications going back and forth or whatever. It's like, you know, this ship felt very real, very operational, very tangible. And that's something that, you know, the time it was made, and you look at it through our eyes now, 50 years later, which is incredible. Wow. And you say, okay, you know, it doesn't look and feel as quote unquote real as the newer shows do, but this one really did to me. It was just something that really that I really got caught up in. It's like, yeah, that's how this should work. Yep, that's what's really happening in the background. Everybody had their bits and parts. And I think as time went on, you know, that part of the show got a little lost. It became more the big three.
Uh-huh.
There were aspects of it in other shows, but this was one where you saw all the elements of what it's like to run a vessel. And I thought they hit it out of the park.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously they do, you know, dramatic shorthand as the series progresses. You know, I mean, you have Kirk,
sure,
Spock, and McCoy doing everything, like even at the end, right? Kirk says, I'm beaming over, taking two people, taking Dr. McCoy, Bailey, you come too. And Spock's like, request permission to, and Kirk says, no, request denied. If it is a trap, if something goes wrong, I want you here. And that's the way they should do it, right? That's the way you shouldn't be bringing the captain and the first officer and the chief medical officer on every single away mission. But, I mean, that's what they do because, of course, Shatner and Nimoy and Kelly are the big three. They're the big stars, and you want them at the center of all the action. You want to see those characters interact, right? That's part of the fun of Star Trek, is seeing, you know, these guys. You want to see them in situations, and you want to see what their reactions to the situations and each other in those situations are. And you put them together, and you put them on the adventures. But yes, just strategically speaking, tactically speaking, not the smartest move to bring the captain and the first officer everywhere, and this episode addresses that. Once again, Ken, as you said, like, yeah, that's the way it should be. Operationally, this checks out, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I know they made those corrections as other shows took over, and they kind of thought it through a little bit more. But then you started to see in other series where the captain was like, I don't have anything to do, and getting frustrated, and they kind of changed the formula a little bit more back to the way the original series worked.
Uh-huh.
Just because you needed to have that, you know, if you're going to spend big bucks on a big name star, which is why I think Discovery will work very well, by the way.
Okay? Look at the modern day tie-in. People, look at you, Ken.
That's right. Well, hey, man, I'll tell you, you know, most of the people that do the operations are not the executive officer or the first officer. It's whoever, you know, if you're going to go board another ship, you have a boarding party that's led by usually a chief, a senior chief, maybe a mid-level officer. That's just the way things work.
Uh-huh.
They very rarely do anything themselves other than make sure the ship is safe and that it's well protected and that the mission is being executed. So that's why, and I was like, oh, okay, if they're going to have this lieutenant commander in Discovery be the center focus of the ship, that's actually more believable because they would probably be assigned to doing a lot more things than the captain, the executive officer would ever be. Because running the day-to-day elements of a ship after the first or second episode would not be very sexy to watch.
Yeah.
You know, it just wouldn't. You know, what's the engine level? How's our fuel? You know, how's our ammunition? How's our training efficiency? What's for dinner tomorrow? You know, that.
Those episodes are good every now and then to kind of change the point of view.
Yeah.
Like the Lower Decks, right? One of the best, most creative episodes of The Next Generation, because you're seeing something that you see every week from a different perspective, right? But if you permanently shifted to that perspective, it would get old after all. Like, man, I really do wonder what they're talking about in the conference room there.
Yeah, but that's why I say what I say, that Discovery could really give you a view, right? I mean, there's been plenty of TV shows, you know, comedies and other things where the person in charge is certainly not the star, uh-huh. you know. You know, they're in there somewhere, but it could be another element of a ship. It could be another element of a team, you know, like platoon or whatever. You're not focused around the person who is in charge. You're focused around the people that are executing the mission. Uh-huh. And that's very realistic.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you've ever seen American Sniper, you never once meet the commanding officer or the SEAL team. You just don't, you know, any of them. It's just funny. It's just, nope, these are the guys. They've been given the mission, and so now the story is to follow the mission. And they could do that very easily with Discovery, and it could be just as interesting. In fact, more interesting to me in many aspects.
Right. Well, I'll look forward to it in a few months, Ken. So,
yeah, if they ever get it done, yeah. That'd be nice.
Well, you know, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about Baylock's point of view during all mm-hmm. this. Like, what is his angle here, Ken? What are your thoughts on his game of cat and mouse or deception or whatever you want to call it, right? Not cat and mouse is not the correct terminology, but you know what bait and switch would be the more appropriate terminology there. What are your thoughts on his game? What's he playing at here?
Well, I would imagine that they have a territory and an area that they wish to defend and keep safe. So if people are going to come exploring into their space, they want to know their character. They want to understand how they would deal with things. Obviously, they have the technology to play all the games and pull all the triggers they want. I thought it was interesting when Baylock says, you know, you could have been, your memory banks could have been loaded with deceptive data, right? So it's like we have to test reality.
Hashtag paranoid versus, right there.
Yeah. But, you know, obviously that's based on something. And I'm sure that, you know, they've had experiences with other races in theory that maybe they thought they were one way and they turned out to be another. And this is a great test. Uh-huh. And of course, the ultimate test was when Baylock's ship was, quote unquote, disabled quite on purpose. What did they do next? Did they just leave? Did they fire on it? Did they do all these things? Nope. They went over there. So it was really a true test. It was Kobayashi Maru for Baylock, looking at these guys and seeing how they handle death, how they handle stress, what's their true intentions? Is it evil? You know, think about it. If that was the Klingons, that buoy would have been destroyed. They would have been firing all the way, in theory, right?
Right.
At the Viserys, it would have been very, very different.
So I guess Baylock would have destroyed the Klingons.
That would be my guess.
I mean, he's a friendly little guy, but
you know, I wouldn't mess with it. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, even the Enterprise, he you know, just before the engines get to the point of blowing up, just at that, you know, he really played it right to the numbers, right? There was a lot of tension in this.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of tension. So, yeah, he was going to push them to every limit that he could to really test if the Federation's intentions were sincere. And that's, you know, that was pretty cool. I thought, from Baylock's point of view, it made sense.
Yeah, and you know, First Federation, kind of a pretentious title to name yourselves. Kind of reminds me of like when you're driving through town and you see like First Baptist Church and First. It's like how many firsts are there? Who's keeping track of who was first during all this? But
that's a different viewpoint there, Zach.
I'm just saying. But the First Federation, rather pretentious title for yourselves. That's fine. So, you know, the whole puppet thing is an interesting approach. Like I said in my summary, I probably have been more frightened if he saw little Clint Howard's face up on the view screen with that, you know, wavy image. And it's funny, you know, I'm sure, putting yourself in the position of someone watching Star Trek for the first time, right? They've seen the movies and they're like, you know what, let me check out what this original series is all about. And they turn on this episode and you see the alien and they're probably like, what is this? This looks like a puppet. This is stupid, right? That's probably their knee-jerk reaction. And then you find out, oh, it is a puppet. Well done, show. You know, little applause there.
Right,
you know?
So I feel like
that's a very effective bait and switch. Where it's like, yes, it was a puppet. And I like the whole wavy kind of effect they have as well, to kind of disguise, you know, what's going on there. And, you know, Spock, in this early episode, Spock's always, like, he's tapping into something to always get, like, a visual feed. He does it here, he does it in Balance of Terror. Like, where is he getting this from? Is he hacking into their webcam, so to speak, you know, to see
them? Yeah, I guess
so.
He has a knack for it.
I was curious to see what they look like. Kirk's like, yeah, of course you were. But anyway, but yeah, no, it's an interesting race here, that the first Federation, and an interesting way to approach things, because obviously the best way to judge somebody's character is to see how they respond to people or things that are worse off than they are, weaker than they are, right? Lower on the totem pole, so to speak. You know, how do you treat those people and those things, and people in crisis, how are you going to treat them? So that is why Baylock, I mean, he comes out all, you know, guns blazing. We're this awesome First Federation. You can't oppose us. But then at the end of the episode, he's this weak guy in a dying ship. And that's the true judge of the character of the Enterprise. What are they going to do to that guy? And that's the lesson learned. And they make friends, right? So, you know, with another race, as you said, the Klingons, the Romulans, who knows who else, might not have gone that way, right? It would have been a more negative ending for both parties, really. But here, it's a nice happy ending. Trania has had by all and relished. So,
yeah, Trania looked good, by the way.
I've never had. See, the people make Trania these days. I know these Star Trek conventions. I think they had like a Trania party. I didn't go to that. They had like a Trania summit on something like that. I'd be curious. It looks. I mean, like, what is it, like a Bloody Mary? Like,
it looks like orange juice to me. It looked orange.
Mimosa. Excuse me. It's the same
mimosa. There
yeah.
you go. Yeah.
Bloody Mary.
Hey, they all look pretty happy. You know. And, you know. The little board that comes up with the very common little bowl and scoop.
Right. Love it.
I get a kick out of
it. Be great at parties. I want that for a party.
Yeah. I think this is a good entryway for people. If, you know, we haven't done this. Many, many other shows do. I don't know if it's an idea we want to tackle because it's been done so many times. But if you're saying what episode would you want to show to introduce people to the original series, this is a very good one because you'll get a feel for the ship, its mission, its team. You'll get the dynamic. You'll get that it's a very effective, efficient crew. I think you'll learn to respect Captain Kirk very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
and his style of things. You know, the sense of humor, everything. And it's amazing. You know, the first season of Star Trek. I mean, it's amazing to think of how fast they developed that chemistry and how good the show was right from the get-go. It really was. Not a lot of Star Treks have had that same launch. You know, it took time for them to find their footing. But this one, you know, they really did have lightning in a bottle. And that's why I still remember to this day in 86 when they announced The Next Generation, they said, there's no way you can capture lightning in a bottle twice. Yeah. And they did, but they didn't find it instantly.
No, so, I mean, everybody says, oh, you got to give these shows time. You know, and like, well, look at the original series. I mean, it was good from the jump, right? I mean, that's why it's such a sci-fi classic. I mean, I think there's almost 30 episodes in the first season. Small handful of misses, very small handful of misses. Everything else is great, and that just shows you don't need two or three seasons to get up to speed, right? I mean, you can actually have an excellent show off the top. And so, ironically, I think of all the series, right, of all the Star Trek shows, the original series would be best served in today's environment where you have to be good from episode one or you're going to get canceled by episode six, right? I mean, like, you look at Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, you know, questionable first seasons, probably their, you know, among their weaker seasons of both shows, for example, those wouldn't have lasted past season one or two in today's, you know, cutthroat television environment. But the original series would have, right? If you, again, you have to, you know, translate and extrapolate from there, but, you know, it's a great, great first season, first production episode. You get to know, like you say, can you get to see the whole crew? You get to know everybody. Yeah, a very good introduction. Now, I understand. I mean, looking at these episodes, even if the special effects were done, I know that's why they had to delay this episode. Even if they were done, I could still see maybe NBC picking the Mantrap over Corbinite Maneuver just because, you know, as you said earlier, it's a bottle show. You're on the ship the whole time. You're on the bridge 80% of the time. You might want a little more action, a little more stuff going on. So go down to a planet and a monster on the loose. So I can see why network executives in the 60s would have said, okay, this is good and all, but it's a little too boring, a little too cerebral, right? And that's the buzzword for NBC in the 60s. So I can see why they would have that mindset perhaps and go with the Mantrap instead of this one. But this Maybe. this one does have more of the Star Trek philosophy, though, right?
it does. I just wonder if the the awe, and like I said, looking at it now, it's a different thing, and I'm watching the remastered one, which is pretty good. But even back then, the special effects were a big deal, and that might have captivated the audience to say, wow, this is a big budget, you know, presentation here.
That's a good
and
point,
I think,
yeah.
You know, and the other piece of it, too, I don't know how this would have played in black and white, as most of the television sets back in especially in its first run, the majority were black and white. So it probably would have looked even that much better. In other words, without all the colors and everything, it's just like, whoa, that's one big badass ship that's coming down at them. I don't know. I mean, sometimes people, I know I am very, very impressed, and we're spoiled, and sometimes it's almost killing your senses with the amount of special effects that are thrown in shows now. It's just almost overwhelming. But when done right, when done with the right measure, it can be very powerful. And I wonder if that might have been a difference. But I hear exactly what you're saying, because this show, like I said, they could have done this show in a half an hour. Uh-huh. And it would have been, you know, the pacing of the show would have made it as exciting as, you know, some of those faster adventurous shows that you were talking about. It would have had a different feel. In today's world, that would have been edited incredibly and would be a wonderful reboot show to make, just with today's effects. I think it would have been really wild to see.
Well, speaking of the effects and the remastered version, I watched the remastered one as well this time. Even though I do have the whole original series on Laserdisc, and I often watch them that way. I did watch the remastered one of this one because I was curious to revisit it, because I hadn't seen the remastered one since it came out, gosh, 10 years ago now. Yikes.
Right.
And this is really one of the best remastered jobs of the whole series, I think, because nothing is too distracting. You know, the cube almost looks identical. I mean, it's a glowing cube, right? I mean, how much can you
change it at
really
all.
Update it, right? It's just a little cleaner around the edges. You know, the Viserys looks a little... what I can only assume were ping pong balls cut in half in the original series that were glowing. Those said they've added some more texture to those. So the Enterprise doesn't do any crazy maneuvers that you wouldn't, you know, ordinarily see. In fact, and again, for the remaster, when it works well, it works when it enhances the story, right? So this is whole thing of like the Enterprise breaking away from this tractor beam, and you get a really cool shot of it, like, okay, we're breaking free, and you see it zoom off to the side, and it just makes sense in the story. It's not some crazy barrel roll or anything like that, but it's a ship that's under stress and it breaks away, and you just see the momentum carry it off to the side, and that kind of stuff is really what enhances the story. When you see the visuals of what they're talking about, not like evasive maneuvers, Mr. Sulu, and you see the ship just sitting there. And then another thing is the counter, right? The infamous counter from the original episode was literally just the thing you'd see on a what's the terminology for that, Ken? I don't know, but
I don't know. It's just kind of like these rolling numbers.
The rolling numbers
instead of versus a digital number.
Yeah, straight out of the 1960s. Yeah. And they made it a digital readout, which was cool to see, which we'll definitely have in the 23rd century. So, yeah, so as remaster goes, big thumbs up for the remastering job on this one.
Yeah, it was very subtle and well done. I like the colors from the cube reflecting back on the ship was something that I noticed, too. Mm-hmm. You know, that was kind of neat. And that was very realistic, I thought, when it was spinning, but they did it right. It was that right measured, which they did throughout the whole remaster. They didn't go crazy with it. They made it so an audience today could appreciate it a little bit more. You know, and now I watch for things I didn't watch before. It's like, oh, okay, does it have the balls at the end of the ship now, or the end of the engines and things like that? Yeah. You know, now I'm like, I'm clued in because of all the conversations we've had on things to look at. But yeah, they did it right. The remastered is a great way to watch it. But the original version, I've got the DVDs, so you can watch them either way. Mm-hmm. And you know, I tend to watch the remastered now. And like I said before, I'm hopeful that they go back again to really try to hook in, and because I think they'd make money off it, but I don't know. They've probably already studied it. But if you took the original series and you made it even more modern, you know, the backdrops and everything like we've seen on a YouTube, I would guess it would sell. I guess we'll see when Discovery comes out and they have the whole portfolio out there and what the draw is. And
let's get Deep Space Nine and Voyager in HD first, and then we can worry about that, huh?
That's right. That's right. And that's where I'm going. If that works, if Discovery pulls in enough, you know, it's a shame too, because I don't know if you saw about 3 or 4 weeks ago, the remerger of CBS and Paramount failed. Hmm. So, you know, from just a Star Trek point of view, that would have been great because we would have been back to one owner where you look at the franchise as one holistic entity, and the funds that drive it would be all commingled or back together again. Now it's still two separate entities. The movies, which they're investing a ton of money in still, versus the TV show, which, you know, one of the points you were making earlier, Zach, was that it takes a while to find their footing, which is precisely why they don't put it on network television, because Star Trek, they say, would not succeed. It just wouldn't, right? It needs that time. Just like TNG was syndicated, it worked. Deep Space Nine was syndicated. Its ratings struggled a lot. And then when they put the last two series on a network, quote unquote, UPN network, obviously they struggled for an audience, even though Voyager made it a whole seven and Enterprise just made it for four. So I think they're doing it right. They're actually playing right to the audience that wants to see it. And we'll see if it drives even more viewers to CBS All Access. And if they have their whole portfolio out there and you want to watch, particularly Deep Space Nine and Voyager and High Def, and who doesn't? You know, maybe this will cause them to do that, because you can't watch these shows. You know, even watching the BBC sometimes, they don't have the remastered TNG on, and it's just like, ooh.
It's tough to watch. It's tough to go back, right? Once you see it in HD, for sure.
So hopefully, this is New Year's weekend, so there's a big TOS marathon going on the BBC. It's all remastered. Looks brilliant. So, you know, it'd be nice to see if those two shows could get that same treatment.
Indeed.
More DS9. You know, that was what I'd really like to see.
We love all Star Trek here on Standard Barbican.
We do. I'd like to see them do it in order as production, and Deep Space Nine would be fun. I own the whole disc series for Deep Space Nine. I've owned it for years, and it was fun to rewatch with my daughter years ago. And it's like, okay, now I'd really like to see what they can do.
Yeah,
I was
holding off
on
rewatching, you know, Deep Space Nine and Voyager, right? Because I said, okay, well, TNG is going to get the Blu-ray treatment. Rewatching that in HD. You know, I've seen so many of these episodes so many times on the other shows. I'm gonna wait, and we're gonna revisit it in HD. And you know, we're still waiting on it in HD. I know they're re-releasing the DVD packages next year. It's like, oh, or by no, 2017 now. Happy New Year! It's like, oh, good, we're getting the DVDs again.
Oh, they are
repackaged. No Blu-rays. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay. Well, anyway.
Well, I guess have they ever offered one huge package of all the series and movies?
No, that would be insane. How many discs would that be?
Like, the closest, you're always looking to remarket something, right?
The closest they've come is they did release all the original series movies, the original series, and the animated series all together this year. And that special release, and it's like, well, I already have most of this stuff already, so I'm not gonna. The one thing that would have pushed me over the edge is if they had put the Star Trek the Motion Picture director's cut in HD, then I would have bought the new set. But they didn't. So
no, you're right. They did Blu-ray the motion picture, but it's the original version,
right?
And it's
when they redid the directors, we're getting on this staple of Standard Orbit, our tangents here, right? But just bear with us, folks. So they. When they redid Star Trek, the motion picture, the director's edition, obviously it was in standard definition for the, for the DVD at the time. Now they made the special effects in a way they could up convert them. Right. But that, you know, time, manpower, computer power, all that, you gotta, you know, re-edit and you gotta pay for all that stuff. And that money's got to come from somewhere. Right. And, unfortunately, because of the CBS and the Paramount rift, you know, the remastering of the films has not been anywhere near the quality or, you know, the attention to detail that the remastering of the shows have been, right? So, I don't know, man. I like you. I was hoping that CBS and Paramount would get back together and maybe we could, you know, revisit some of these things we've been hoping to see for a while. And the director's edition of the motion picture in HD is certainly one of them. So,
yeah, that would be, if there was anything I'd like to see first before any of them, it'd be that. But anyway, we'll see where it goes.
Cool. Well, any final thoughts on this episode then, Ken?
Just watch it. If you haven't seen it in a while, watch it. Join us on the Babel Conference. Give us your comments looking through it after all this time. If you've been watching a lot of other Star Trek lately, if you've been watching a lot of the other series, which I think is great, I would never say don't, come back and check this one episode out and see how it plays to you, how it measures up to a lot of the other series that have, like I said, this is an original Star Trek episode that began a very... Maybe one of these episodes we can come back and we can talk about all the different shows that mirrored this in the future. But we could do that with our Earl Grey and TTJ friends one of these days in Enterprise. You know, we find an episode that's similar in how it was handled. But I think you'll appreciate this being the one that started it all.
Absolutely. You know, and I will encourage you guys, look, if you only listen to one Star Trek podcast, listen to Standard Orbit. But if you listen to two Star Trek podcasts, listen to Standard Orbit and Mission Log. Right, which is, you know, we're happy to have on a Trek FM network here with John Champion and Ken Ray. And they have a great episode on their podcast discussion about the Corbin Wright maneuver. They hold this up as like one of the finest hours of Star Trek, which really, you know, embodies and encapsulates what Star Trek and its philosophy is all about. And they're absolutely right. You know, listening to Mission Log, gosh, it's been, I don't know how long ago when they first started, this was one of the first episodes they did. And it's like, man, they gave me a new appreciation for this episode, right? Listening to the conversation.
Yeah. I haven't listened to
it. So it's definitely, I recommend it to you. Can recommend it to anybody out there. And then if you listen to more than two podcasts, we have lots of other great ones here on Trek FM. But, but anyway, I just wanted to give them a shout out there because that's a great podcast and that's a great conversation about the Corbin Wright maneuver. An often overlooked episode gets lost in the shuffle when people talk about the original series. And then finally, during our discussion here, not that I wasn't paying attention to you, Ken, with everything you were saying, but I did look up, the book that just came out. It's called The Face of the Unknown, which I mentioned earlier. It is a sequel to the Corbin Wright Maneuver. It's by Christopher L. Bennett, who is, you know, a very noted author who's written many a novel, many a Star Trek novel. And I'll just read you guys the description here so you can kind of know what to expect. So when you watch this episode, based off our recommendation, of course, you're like, yeah, First Federation, all right, good stuff, and you want to follow up. This would be a good book to pick out, and it just came out in December of 2016, so it's, you know, fresh off the press.
Wow, that is new.
And this is the description. Investigating a series of violent raids by a mysterious predatory species, Captain James T. Kirk discovers that these events share a startling connection with the First Federation, a friendly but secretive civilization contacted early in the USS Enterprise's 5-year mission. Traveling to the First Federation in search of answers, the Enterprise suddenly comes under attack from these strange marauders. Seeking refuge, the starship finds its way to the true home of the First Federation, an astonishing collection of worlds hidden from the galaxy beyond. The inhabitants of this isolated realm are wary of outsiders, and some accuse Kirk and his crew for bringing the wrath of their ancient enemy down upon them. When an attempt to stave off disaster goes tragically wrong, Kirk is held fully accountable, and Commander Spock learns there are even deeper forces that threaten this civilization. If Kirk and Spock cannot convince the First Federation's leaders to overcome their fears, the resulting catastrophe could doom them all. Well, I don't know about you. But that sounds pretty exciting. So
yeah, that sounds really cool.
I don't know if Bailey plays a role in that. Maybe I would assume he'll at least you know, garner a mention. But there you go. There's a nice follow up to the Corbin Wright maneuver in book form, fresh off the presses, guys. So definitely go check that one out.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I'll be watching too to see if Literary Checks pulls that up.
Well, it's been fun discussing the Corbin Wright maneuver, but that isn't the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this past week. Here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. Earl Grey.
And then as kind of a teenager, I kind of drifted a bit from Star Trek, and, you know, I pretended one time when I went to see Star Trek Nemesis that I was actually off to see Elf instead because that sounded cooler than seeing Star Trek Nemesis. And maybe it still is.
To the journey!
Maybe even playing it with Tuvok, who I think will be brilliant at it, and then it just constantly going brr, brr, like him just getting really annoyed.
Yeah. Tuvok would be the Operation Champ.
Yeah, he would, yeah.
See, and then the evil holographic doctor from Equinox is singing, you know, the reticular nodes connected to the...
Yes.
Warp 5.
We should get Larry Nemechek on, and we should do a supplemental episode where we just talk and we act like we're Tellarites and we just insult each other for the whole episode.
He would probably love it.
What do you think? I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I don't know. That would be... I might have to get coached by our listeners.
Meta Treks.
And that's the world of language that we live in. It's not this purely referential sense of language. Like when Riker says a minuet, he doesn't just mean, oh, yeah, that thing minuet that I can point to, whatever that is on the holodeck, right? The
17th century French dance. Maybe he wants to dance.
Riker wants to bust a move.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and helps us increase our visibility for new listeners.
If you'd like to get in touch with us here at trek.fm, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm, facebook.com/trekfm, and the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
So let me talk to you for a second about Patreon, Zach. Patreon is the program that Trek FM employs in order to get donations to keep the network coming to you commercial free. It is wonderful. Most of the hosts here on Trek FM are big contributors to Patreon and found our way onto the network through Patreon. So if you can spare any money, and we don't care what the denomination is, it really means a lot to us because there is a lot of content that we're putting up there, a lot of bandwidth, a lot of programming, a lot of equipment that we need. So please, if you can help us out, we'd appreciate it. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and you can click any donation you want. And we do have some incentives for you. So for $15 a month, you get to join the Patrons Roundtable where you podcast. And you know, again, that is where a lot of us started. It was on the Roundtable. I was on the very first one. I had a blast. And if you can contribute $25 or more per month, then you get associate producer credits for whatever show you like. And we love our associate producers. So please, 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 if you have the ability, it is more than appreciated. And speaking of our associate producers, we'd like to thank Renee Roberts, Richard Rutledge, and Aaron Harvey. Thank you so much, always, for your support for both Standard Orbit and the Trek FM network. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701. You can find Richard at rut8972. And you can find our buddy Aaron Harvey at geekfilter. So if you're looking for me on the network, you can find me on the Babel Conference. I'm always on there, pre-post shows, talking different subjects with all our listeners. And you can also find me on Twitter at Boston SCPO. That means Boston Senior Chief Petty Officer.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show from the early 2000s, and we're on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And also, I'm around the Babel Conference as well. It's always great to talk to you guys on there, making conversation about our shows, other shows, general Star Trek topics, anything, really. Love to talk to you guys on there. So thanks for listening, everyone. And join us again next time here on Trek.fm for another episode of Standard Orbit.